to another episode of Let It Ride. Here we talk long hair in business, advocate for hair equality, and celebrate men's long manes with hair whips, and of course, high fives. If you're a guy with long hair, you're in the right place.
I'm Sean Horton, a.k.a. Elefante, creative director of the Long Hairs, and I'm joined by the president of the Long Hairs, Lindsay Bartow, a.k.a. El Moreno.
Yo, what's up?
And illustrious and talented media producer, Garv, a.k.a. El Garvinsky. Today, before I introduce our very special guest, who's a dear friend of mine, I want to remind you guys that not every guy needs to be a hair expert, but there are a few things that every guy with long hair needs to know. Things like washing frequency, brushing technique, how to deal with the naysayers, and much more over at Quick Tips. It is our free guide on the basics of hair care, and you can sign up at the link in the description. And now, the main event. Hailing from the land of walleye, fish, and tater tots, also known as Minnesota, he's a multidisciplinary creative force who at his age still shows no signs of stopping. Known for his fatherly wisdom, always delivered mere inches from your face and typically over a cold beer or glass of red wine, he has spent the last several years building a reputation for himself as the guy who gets shit done. He's sold dozens of contemporary paintings to high-end hotel chains and has had his work in galleries from San Diego all the way to Spain. Woo! Prior to that, he could be found roaming the halls and boardrooms of Foot Locker as an advertising executive during their booming renaissance of the mid-80s. Mm. He's a builder of restaurants, installer of graphics, thinker of thoughts, and speaker of words that sometimes make you go, huh?
Badass.
In the time I've known him, he has had his hand in more big projects than I can count on all my fingers and toes. He is a mysterious maker of many things, the prolific protagonist of his own epic drama, the legendary lurker of Logan Avenue. He is Gary Harper.
Yeah.
Welcome. Welcome, Gary. You are now letting it ride. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Great having you, dude.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. You forgot a few things.
We left out a lot of things so we'd have something to talk about.
Okay, yeah.
Let's start off with young Gary.
Oh, young Gary.
Tell me about like your growing up and what were your interests like?
Sure. Midwest upbringing. Pretty much workaholic people that just made sure that you got. I think the thing that I remember most is if you're gonna dig ditches, dig them better than anybody else.
Wow.
So you know it was kind of ground into your head: work ethic, work ethic, work ethic. And so when you went out into the real world, starting young age, seven of us in the family, five boys, two girls, all the boys left-handed, every boy left-handed.
No
so
way.
Our house was a little bit different than anyone else's house on the block because all the left-handed people in a row had our own communication devices, ADHD, you know, a little bit creative, some crazy things, very hard to monitor, keep things stable. But responsibility came with the growing up. When you're five or seven of us at the same time, you did everything. There was a sheet on the door. Your grandmother came to visit. Check marks had to go on that board or you were just goodbye.
Uh-huh.
Mm. There was a few words spoken, but brushes were taken out if it was not a right thing to do. So a lot of us got in trouble, but you know we had a kind of a group, a family. So when my brothers went to school, and they started to have to go through the system, it wasn't easy because the right-handed people taught differently than our brains were thinking. So he didn't like it. First and second grade, I had to walk him to and from school every day, generally twice. Because
Your younger brother? Yeah, Doug. He came to visit.
Uh-huh. So one of the things about being in a big family is you learn how to get along with any personality from a young age. Whether you liked them, whether you didn't like them, you had to get along. You were living in a house with probably three or four bedrooms, you know, so you had to use different parts of the house. And my room was the basement. Loved the basement because no one was down there. We had a pool table, so there was an exercise. So I started painting and drawing probably young age, can't remember. I remember the newspaper came out and said, if you can draw like this, send it in and we'll send you to school. And I sent it in.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard back from them, so I didn't know for years that was a gimmick. But I wanted to get recognized for my art because when in a family of that big, it's hard to get any attention at all. One of the things I did was a Wall Street Journal would come in, or encyclopedias my mom would buy would come in, and I'd go through and look for pictures to replicate. Mm. I'd start by making them bigger. And I realized that I liked doing it for the escape, that my brain did something different than any other way that I'm visual and auditory learning. I'm not the same as when you're in school. I had dyslexia, second grade. They kicked me into a special class. Special class was cool because there were only six of us in there.
Yeah.
And the teacher was like one-on-one with you.
Yeah. I did the same thing.
I only lasted two weeks in special class. I lasted 2 weeks because they found out I needed glasses and I was dyslexic. And she taught me one of the things that brought me through probably to high school. And she made me look at the alphabet, you know, the big letters above, yeah. And then they did the go write what you see. And all my round letters were backwards, B's, C's, S's. Okay. And she said, okay, now I'm going to teach you how to look at what you did, lift it up off the board into the air, turn it around, and put it down the way the top one is. So she taught me early.
Yeah.
How to overcome obstacles that probably would have been more difficult. And I don't know how it was a public school system. Great teacher. Can't remember her name, but thank you for...
Yeah.
She did a great job. All the way through, still no interest really in school. Just couldn't... Math, history... I could study it in the encyclopedia, but you couldn't teach it to me. Mm-hmm. My attention span was gone. Got to high school, did a couple of attempts to make it through high school. Did all right. English teacher, George Shell. Thank you, George. Saw me wander in the halls, saw that I was different, took me into his class and said, we're going to do theater. You are going to be involved in music, art, and theater. And you're going to be excused from all your other classes. We're going to give you and they had a special contest in Minnesota at that time for the Guthrie Theater. And the Guthrie Theater had a summer program where 600 kids applied and six kids got to go. And I was selected as one of the kids who got to go for 3 years in high school to study modern dance, theater. So a lot of the famous actors that were in new television at the time, Peter, I can't remember his name, Man from U.N.C.L.E., was one of the people who was one of the teachers at the Guthrie Theater. So my days in the summer were playwriting, art, karate classes, sword fighting, anything that, you know, and then they made you do a performance at the end of each year. Mm. One of the performances to this day probably taught me the most about myself is fear is nothing except something to overcome.
Mm. Yeah.
Try to overcome fear because it's the biggest obstacle to what your creative energy is. You're not going to fit in everywhere. Mm. And that exercise was, they made us announce, we had to write a play with each other, interact with each other, and then the day of the performance, take off all your clothes.
Oh, God.
The audience was theater in the round, and these were the people who sponsored the Guthrie Theater. Only the elite members were in this audience, and they're 2 feet away from the stage. Mm. Take off your clothes, and you're performing nude.
Wow.
What?
Yes.
You're in high school?
In high school.
Damn, dude.
That's
It
was theater, so you gotta get over it. So you take off your clothes, you perform. Now, your brain goes through a few crazy things, but what you realize is you're looking out into the darkness. They can see you, but you can't see them. So it was not unlike having clothes on because you're trying to overcome the fact that the biggest obstacle is you might get embarrassed, but now you got to perform like you have completely all of everything on. And so it taught me, whenever you're stuck in a really difficult situation, pretend you're nude. And just get over it. Just, you know, they're the ones who got to adjust. They got to figure it out. So throughout my whole life, that was the biggest, greatest gift that teacher could have given me was, here, go do what you do. Now, he would take me out of my classes, and he made me, for the 3 years I was in high school, take kids who didn't know, because I was trained in the summer, anything about theater, write, direct, and perform a play. My art teacher was a part of that, so I was kind of, I think I was voted, yeah, I was, most talented. It wasn't even a category. And I didn't know what that meant, because we were printing pictures in the print shop. We had workshop. We were building things out of metal. We were directing plays. So my whole education was about art, theater. And so now you go out into the real world.
Yeah.
You graduate high school. I was fortunate enough to be in a big enough family where we were careful about who had academic training and who would never survive college, even if you wanted to. And my mom said, can't afford to send everybody to school. We're going to send your sister. That's the way it's going to be. And I was like 100% behind that, because she was she wanted
she
to be a teacher.
The chosen one.
She wanted to be a teacher. And I said, like, that's great. So now you're 17, 18 years old. For my high school graduation, my mother gave me a suitcase. I didn't know what that meant.
Oh, wow.
But she said to me, you should see the world now while you have time.
Nice.
Well, you,
that's pretty great advice.
You should just go and see the world. I think it was because one less person in the house was probably a really cool thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But in the end, it was like I took off. So I lived in a commune with some friends probably for 5 years. So I had different degrees of friendships. The crazy ones, the medium ones, and the straight ones. And you interacted with all of them. The straight ones are really mad because I lived in a commune, and for I think I disappeared for 3 years, just whatever was going to happen, we were going to do it. And those are still some very good friends of mine that forever are going to be around, still call on birthdays, still talk to each other. So it was a bond, sort of like we developed before gangs were gangs. You had a group of people. Just,
well, can we paint this picture of this commune just a little bit more? Were you guys in a building together? Or?
Yeah, it was an apex.
Okay.
It was an old beat up apex. So there were apartments, 8 apartments. Okay. And there were my friend and I, Donnie, we had one. And Lucy and her friend had another one. And several people had another one. So we would do... well, let's see. After the entertaining evening that we'd go out and have no business being in that place because we didn't have a ID, we'd come home and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and my friend would invite the entire, we used to go to this place called the Caboose Bar in Minnesota and it was a rank and good place. This place, one day we walked in, walked through the stage and the voice sounded familiar. I looked up, it was Mick Jagger.
No
he was
way.
Playing at the Caboose. So
wow.
You're like, hey, there's Mick Jagger. And that's how we kind of did it, you know, and I like, hey, give me a signature. It's just like, oh, cool, Mick Jagger's here.
Yeah.
And then we got kicked out of that place because some guy tried to assault the woman we were with and we got in a fight. So we got thrown out into the motorcycles, laid down. So it was a pretty wild experience growing up. Now, you'd come home, and he'd invite the bar to the house. So now it's 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning. You're gonna have breakfast, so the whole house would be a participant. Who's got waffles, who's got, so like a big conference area where we'd all congeal and meet. And it was like this whole communal living for 3-4 years of life. My friend and I, we used to do sports at the same time. So we got good at tennis, got good at golf. We did some things that were looking like we should probably go that direction instead of where we were going. And we took off for California in a 1963 Rambler. Sang songs all the way out. I had just got through going through after school for sign painting because my girlfriend's sister was getting married. And they needed an invitation, and I wrote one out of script. And nice. She goes, that's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And she introduced me to a guy who was the head of the union. And I went to see him, and he said, well, if you're going to be a sign painter, you got to go to school. So for 2 years, I went to night school. one of the classes was, you're good at what you do, but now let's see if you can do art. Mm. So before today's murals that are made out of graphics, they were all hand painted.
Yeah, right.
Sides of buildings.
Yeah.
So when I'm going to night school to learn how to paint, he said, I want you guys to go home and bring in any art that you have at your house. Whoever has the best art at the end of this season of school, you're going to have a job. So we brought in two pieces of art each, and he put them up in front of the whole class. You know, that's the first experience I think I had where I didn't think my art was any good.
Yeah.
I just, no self-confidence. Nobody was feeding it as I was growing up. You're going to go into business. You're going to do something else. We're not going to let you do anything like that. You're never going to make any money. You're not going to amount to anything. And so I just started, and the teacher picked two of us. At the end of the year, he brought us into his shop. All you really did was schlep paint for the masters, because you were just out of school, so you're an apprentice. So you here's clean your brushes. You weren't allowed to touch a painting. There was a Dutch Masters. My first one was a Dutch Masters, 40 feet long, 15 feet high, and they painted the figures of the Dutch Masters. They weren't graphically illustrated like today. They were hand-painted. And the first time the master gave me the brush, it was just a small little person that I was supposed to fill in the details. And that was like, wow, you finally... You can drive down the freeway and see it, and you go like, I see a little piece in the corner. And then it gradually became like the sides of buildings were getting painted with advertisement for movies or things like that. So slowly he'd bring us in and say, hey, go do this, go do that. And you're working on a mass scale. You're this close to the piece. You have an outline of what you're supposed to paint in color. So you learned this perspective versus looking at it from miles away.
Yeah.
And it's a valuable lesson. Today, we're doing some work in Chicano Park with a mural, and I was assisting a person. I said, like, you got to remember that when I'm here this close, I'll use an example. I've been kicked out of the Museum of Modern Art in New York simply because from 50 feet away, I saw a painting that I just was enamored with, and it was beautiful. It looked like a water scene, just whites and blues, and reflections were beautiful, and I kept getting closer, and it kept getting more and more smudged, and more and more smudged, and I got right up to the painting, and I'm like, I can't believe that this guy could put that stroke down, just like, nah, nah, nah. The alarm goes off. I'm going, you're leaving. Three times I think that happened to me in different museums, because I'm just enamored with how did they see something, and that's, to me, a valuable lesson. So now I go to California. I'm painting, sign painting in La Jolla, the backs of the names on boats, and my friend that I was with decided to take off. They're building a cement boat. They took off for Hawaii. I didn't think I wanted to go back to Hawaii. So I said, okay. I got back to Minnesota somehow. I don't remember if I drove or if I flew, but I landed, went back and knocked on my ex-girlfriend's door and said, hey, I just need a place to crash for a bit, you know? see what's going on. It's, okay, cool. So I stayed there for a while, and I looked in the newspaper. And an advertisement said athletic, also if you're that, come and take an interview. And I went to the interview, and I was hired at Foot Locker in 1978 as a salesman. Now this made my family pretty happy, because prior to that I was moving in a direction where I'm probably not going to land safely anywhere. I'm going to get a full-time job and go to work. And so Foot Locker was expanding rapidly at that time. So 2 months I was in Minnesota. 2 months later I was an assistant manager in Joliet, Illinois. 2 months
later. So wait, just your intro job, you were just a basic, just on the ground store.
I like sports. That was it. And I just decided I'm going to go do it. So they hired me and we did good. So I was doing good. So they were opening stores, 150 stores a year.
Yeah.
So the training program was, you had to be, they had pamphlets teach you everything. It was a really good company. you need to know this to be an assistant manager. You need to know this to be a manager. Okay. You need to know this to be a manager trainer. You need to know this to be a district manager. So they had hierarchical systems. Well, in like 6 years, 3 years, 5 years, I don't remember, I was running my own stores. I was a manager trainer. The next step for manager trainer was either New York City in the office or out in the region as a regional manager, district manager. I good with people, but one of the things that happened, and I think it's important that people recognize you have a skill set and it stays with you no matter what. Mm. So it was the manager trainer, I was about to be promoted to my own store. He came in and he's going on vacation. And while he was gone, I said, you know, this doesn't make any sense that I got women's shoes over there and women's clothing over there and men's shoes over there and tennis is over there. And so I rearranged this entire store and I made boutiques. I made like, here's the men's tennis section and everything to do with tennis.
Yeah.
Here's the men's basket. And he comes in and he looks around and they were very strict. You do it this way and that's it.
Yeah.
So he was like, mm-hmm. he looked at me and he goes like, what did you do to my store?
Yeah.
I had hand painted signs, tennis
nice.
Sections, you know,
yeah. yes.
you know yes, yes. tennis players going out, you know, women and doing, you know, aerobics and that, you know, the whole thing, you know, and so he was like, you know, I really appreciate what you've done, but we can't leave it like, well, it stuck with him. So when I got my own store, they're responsible for a year for us. So like they watch everything. So he would make sure I stayed. He eventually got promoted to regional, and so he became my regional. And then when I became a manager trainer, he became like the president of Foot Locker.
Oh, wow.
So when I was moved around, not knowing, you know, there was a plan. Someone had a plan, gratefully.
Mm-hmm.
He's good at this, so when we get to a point where we can do this. So he eventually, after being in, I think I was in New Jersey in my store. I was in Paramus, New Jersey. And he said, hey, we got an opening in visual display and we want you to take it. So I was moved into the office. Now, no college education, no training background, nothing, you know. I'm in a department in New York City, 233 Broadway, right in the Wall Street. And I'm like, this is kind of a cool thing, but I got my own office. I'm like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
And I realized this responsibility, he wants to change the way that things have been done, find a new way to do this.
Okay.
Because everyone, so one of the tests was
and
like,
you doing his store years ago.
Yeah, it came
stuck
back.
With him.
It came back, right? So now he goes, so you just do that. Well, I was doing that for about a year and a half, and then there was a merge that they were going to take the advertising department and merge it with the visual display department. So okay. I was going to have a new boss other than report to the general manager. I was going to have a vice president of marketing, a senior vice president of marketing, somebody. And they were looking for a marketing director to take over for Foot Locker because they were going to, that she went on maternity leave and decided not to come back.
Mm.
And I went up to the senior person and I said, I'll do it. I don't even need a raise. I just think I can do it.
Yeah.
So I know nothing. You know, she's kind of looking at me like, you know, Gary, you know, this is kind of, you know.
What's the title again? Marketing director?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They called it retail brand director at the time because they wanted you to direct the brand.
Okay.
They said, you're going to be responsible for the advertising. So suddenly she looks at me and goes like, well, let's give it a shot. You know, so I did. So for three, I don't know why. ADD, dyslexic, old lessons. If you're going to do it better than anybody else, ingrained in your brain. Mm. I went to the advertising people, and I said, I know nothing about this. And he said, well, if you want, I'll spend two or three nights after work with you, and I'll run you through these programs. So for like 6 months, I spent every night, three nights a week or four nights a week, what is a BDI, brand development index? What is this? How does this work? Where does this dollar allocate to? How does this work? How do you prove this? How do you do that? And so I just sort of picked it up. So it started working. And at that time, we were working with major athletes. We were working with Don Mattingly. We were working with Every athlete that you can imagine came through the door, and we were filming commercials with them. And I kept looking at this thinking there must be a different way to do this. I'm spending $56 million a year on my advertising. Nike is spending, I don't know, $140 million on their advertising, and we're not talking to each other.
Right. So hey, but you're selling their stuff.
I'm selling their stuff. Yeah. And so I said, I'm going to think about this train ride home, you know, hour and a half to get 20 minutes away in New York, and every day my brain would go like, what if we did? So I decided I'm going to call it vendor supported marketing. And what that's going to be is I'm going to film a commercial of the shoe that's specific to our store. Mm-hmm. I'm going to film it in the Foot Locker store at the front of the store on one of the stands that we have with a promotion about what it is. And then I'm going to say, share in the advertising with me. I'll spend this much for a season, like $6 million, and you spend, like, give me $3 million. I can go to $9 million. We can get more coverage, more play. So the executives had to go through every one of my executives, and they said, Gary, sounds like a good idea. Set something up. So I called Nike. My friend at Nike was an advertising director. I go, I'd like to talk to. So we fly to Beaverton, Oregon. And I'm sitting in a room with their president, their vice president, my senior vice presidents, my presidents are all behind me. I present the program to the president of Nike at the time. And the final statement was, are you out of your effing mind? There's no way that I'm going to do this. You can leave my building and never, ever step foot in it again. So that was not a fun flight home.
Wow.
Okay, so that the next day, my boss, he said, you know, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to Reebok, because I walked up to the president before I left, and I go, I just want to make sure I heard what you said. He goes, what do you mean? I go, did you just say no to me?
Yeah.
And he goes, yes. I go, woo, woo, train's leaving the station, mofo. I'll see you later. He goes, why you say that? Because now you gave me permission to go to the second. You just told me I had to come to you first. You're our biggest client. Now we got another one. So I flew to Reebok the next day. You may be familiar with a shoe called the Pump. That was the first one. We filmed that commercial for the Reebok Pump. Sold 180,000 pair of shoes in 3 days.
Jeez.
Gone. Our liquidated the entire stock in 3 days.
With that promotion, with the vendor supported.
So the commercial
Reebok was right on board. They're right on board.
Well, it took a minute.
Okay.
Go like, hey, let's, you know. And they forgot they signed the contract with me afterwards, because when it hit, they were like, because they had to scramble. We actually diverted another 180,000 pairs of shoes from our competitor. They gave us them back, and we managed to get through that period of time with that promotion. But what they found out is it sold levels under it. If it didn't have that, they would say, let's see what else is close. They knew, so it did. So 6 months goes by, and at the time, cell phones were big things, crazy, so you didn't really have them at home.
Right.
But my phone rang at home, and it was the director of marketing at Nike. And he goes, Gary, what's up? And I go, like, hey, man, you haven't called me at home ever.
Yeah.
And he goes, what's up? He goes, well, I just wanted to know, you told me $6 million last to do that. I go, hey, what are you asking? He goes, well, the president wants to know what it's going to take to get it next year. And I said, $12 million.
Oh, yeah.
He said, okay, done. So they did it. And I said, can you tell me why?
Yeah.
And he goes, our futures went down 5%.
Wow.
So I said, okay, so it worked.
Yeah.
The program. Now, if you think about this program, you put it all together, it still comes back to art. Everything in my life, basically, whatever success I had doing things, I was no longer afraid. That thing I told you about in the beginning.
Dude.
You just don't be afraid to take a, what do you got to lose? You know, it might be a good idea. Why are you afraid to step out and do that next crazy thing?
Yeah.
And fear, I call it FUD. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt show up at your house every day. Yeah. They're sitting on their couch, watching you make your coffee, watching you. And they're deciding, they're going like, hey, dude, which one of us? No, let's all get him today.
Yeah.
Let's all go after him today.
Right.
So that you have to realize in a mental exercise every day, they have cousins, the three C's. Mm. They're going to come. You got to invite them. They're not going to show up. What is the opposite of fear? Courage. Mm-hmm. You got to invite them. What is the opposite of uncertainty? Certainty.
Mm-hmm.
You got to invite it. Every day, let them battle out what you're going to do.
Yeah.
So you got your courage, certainty, and conviction. You got to make sure you're 100%. The three C's don't come. Fudge shows up just waiting for you to say, hey, babe, how's it going? So let them figure it out. Maybe fear won that day, but conviction says, like, you're just going to do it anyway.
Yeah,
you just get, you know, but you're gonna come in with a mix, and if you're coming in with all three, you're an arrogant piece of whack. So don't. You may need that occasionally, but you know, it's, you don't want to carry that around. You gotta have a little humility with everything you do. Sometimes, just manipulate the system, but you have to invite them. So when that happened, this whole business took off. It's like things were just flying. My calendar was filled up with different vendors in 12 months ahead of time. Like, promotions were coming, you're going to get an executive position, you're going to be titled, you're going to do all this. And it was all good, but it's like an uncomfortable falsehood. Mm. It's like part of you is an imposter doing this.
Were you thinking, like, I'm not good enough for all this?
You do. They're actually, you're being convinced of that on a regular basis. It's like, you know, how many times was I fired? There was a board meeting every Friday or Thursday, I don't remember. And all of the senior executives were sitting around the table, and my name was usually last. And I'm usually the furthest away at the table, closest to the door, because what I'm going to bring up is probably not going to fly. It's going to, you know, you're going to get fired. You could feel it. And they would all look at me like, you know, little arrows are coming out. People were like, you know, he's, hey, you. And then the senior president at that time would say, Gary, stick around. And I'm like, oh, here we go again. So one day I just sat there, the board, it's like the big table, all the way 13, 14 chairs down, and I just got up and I walked up to the back of the chair and I spun it so I could whisper in his ear, and I, you don't like me very much, do you? He goes, no, I don't. I said, well, I don't like you either, but there's a difference. He goes, what's that? I don't give a f-. And I don't know what made me do it, honestly. So I kept going, and things were still progressing. We did a lot of the other programs that involved cooperative advertising, and we were making good business, was profitable, everything was flying. And I think I was married at the time, and my wife said, you know, I want to take a job somewhere else. I want to leave New York. So I went up and I resigned, you know, and everybody was like, what? In the middle of this, with all this you're doing? I go, well, if I did it here, I can do it somewhere else. You know, I was really confident that, you know, what the heck? If you can make it here.
New York, city.
You know, you gotta. But we walked through it, and I quit and went back and became the director of marketing for a friend of mine who worked for a biomedical company. I've known for 45 years, and they interviewed me for the job. And I told them, I don't think this is for me. We're looking for something different. And I go, but you know, I don't know. I'm not college educated. I don't know anything about biomedical. I don't know. They call me up. We want you. So I go, okay, so we did that, and I did that for like some 2 years, and I think the transition, leaving a big corporation on the top and then now going to a small company to build it,
mm-hmm.
and seeing that the application of what I did do for a living, maybe I can apply. So I did take some of the background and put it in place, and they went from $3 million a year to $20 million a year in the first year. And not an easy thing to do because they want me to train people, and I said, no, I want to hire people. I don't want to train them. I want to hire the people. They're more expensive, yes, but it's going to be quicker and faster. They already have a client base. They already know the product line. They already can, you know, just went through that. Yeah. Well, they fought me, and then I won, and I said, no. So we had to filter out people and bring in new people, and when we did, it took off, and so I just went, okay, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Then they asked me, like, hey, can you get, so we invented, again, I don't know where creativity comes from. I don't know why you're inspired by stupid things that sound impossible.
Sure.
I don't know how you can make something happen out of, doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But I said, hey, if we're going to attract the number, we were like number 20 in the vendors of people available. If we're going to go to the top, we got to get the top guys involved. They're got to, maybe we should do a program where we, here's the product, here's what it does, and here's where you get it. That was the history. So we started doing infomercials for, we're going to tell you, if you buy X number of the product and you're in an X market, there's 5 slots available to be part of an advertising program that we can send clients to you. So we developed a training program for the offices. We developed a, you know, again, I don't know why these things, they just, so we did, and it started to propel, and it went, I decided one day, we finished the infomercial, I'm done, and I was at a friend's house in Laguna, and I'm looking out his bay window over the ocean, and the sun was setting, one of those really magnificent skies.
Yeah. Sure.
The orange rips and the yellows and the ocean turned those colors. And I was not drinking or doing any other things, and I got down on my knees and put my hand on the window and touched it and said, that's just like I was painting with my fingers.
Wow.
And I quit.
No
that
way.
Day. I just said, I'm done. I can't. I don't think corporate is the place for me to execute this, who this is.
Yeah.
And I'm 46, 47 years old.
At that time.
At that time.
Yeah.
And I went, I don't care anymore. I felt like I was an imposter in the, now can you take this thing, I said, and make this that's inside you something?
Mm-hmm.
Can you do that? Can you, another fear, you know? Well, I had to kind of downsize. Get rid of the big car, got rid of the house, got rid of the, you know, let's modify, let's simplify, let's, and I started to paint, just like I'm going to paint, and moved into a friend's house with one room, you know, in the back, and she had a big backyard, and I was painting, and displayed the paintings at some place, a small little place, and the work started to, people saw it and liked it, and I went, oh. So, again, fear comes in. Here comes FUD, steps up to the door. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think I'm any good at this. How can I don't know this. Now, in the art world, like, you know, are you going to be like that?
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know what pushed you through. You just kept doing it and then displayed it a couple of places and started out at maybe $200, $500 a painting. And then I decided, well, if I apply my business acumen to this model, maybe there's something that can be done. So I developed a brochure for myself. I put in a you know, like an artist portfolio, and here's history, and started selling some paintings. And then I'd walk into a gallery, and I'd go, I got some art, and you know, what do you got? And one of the, this was in Escondido. I think I was in Escondido at the time. I walked in, and the guy says, yeah, I like your art. How many do you have? I think I imagined I had 6, but I didn't. And he goes, when can you have 40? And I go, why? He goes, well, I'm going to give you a one-man show. I go, what? So I went home and invested in more materials and more time and put together 40 paintings.
Holy shit.
But at the same time, I was sending out information to all my old contacts. Hey, I'm an artist now. I'm going to sell art. We got the show coming. Well, a few of them responded and said, like, hey, we'd like to come to the show. And I go, like, cool. And a few more responded, goes, I really like that painting. How much is it? Now, the first time you say a number, you know, you got to kind of, what do you want to do? You got to survive. You got to live.
Right.
What's a livable? How much should I invest? You can do the pragmatic school thing. Well, this much material.
Yeah.
I spent that many hours on it. And I just went $7,500 and said, I'll take it.
Nice.
Went, what?
Your first gallery
your
sale.
Your first gallery
was
sale.
$7,500.
Hell yeah.
With no
dude.
Representation.
No representation
you
at all.
You just went in hawking, peddling your wares.
We're out there.
Because I'm driving in the car, and my wife was sitting next to me, and she heard me because I go, like, $7,500. She goes,
what?
And I went, She said, I'll take it. And I went, okay, great. So before the show opens, I sold a painting that we had in the front window. Now, there was a painting that scared me to death while I was working on the 40. It didn't know what it wanted to be. And painting is weird because you're either totally going to make that canvas what you want, or it's going to tell you, I don't want to do that. And you're going to fight. And it just kept fighting. Mm. I want to be something else. I want to be something else. I want to be something else. And so we managed to get through it. And I said, at the end of the show, we had everything in the thing. And it's still on the ground. And my wife looked at me and said, like, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to burn it. Because it just can't make up its mind, and it's just terrible. I had so many materials on it, marble dust and freaking, the thing was just thick with, and it was still resins wet, you know, and I took my spatula because I wanted to save the canvas, and I started to scrape off the paint, and I went, oh my God, 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 and all the colors that were coming out, and I just could, I be careful how you move, don't leave a drip on the finger thing, and it was beautiful, this no end way. Piece with this scrape.
Dude. Yeah.
So I took a piece of metal, a patinaed piece of metal, and I made it more dented and everything, and I glued it to the center and this piece, and I brought it to the, I put it in the back of the truck when I'm, and so the irony of being identity, your own identity, you know, you're just who you are,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Struck me as like two things, because I'm the one who put the sign on the window because I'm a sign guy. So I put the name of the gallery. I put the show we're doing, the name of the artist. And I'm outside while people are coming in the door. And and I'm putting the sign up. They don't know.
They didn't even know you're the artist.
You go in the back room, put on your beret and your leather pants, and you come back out. Oh, you're the artist. Yeah. I'm the same guy.
Yeah. Right?
But you can't do that. There's like a show. And you got to put it.
You got to be the guy.
You got to be the guy.
You can't be the sign painter.
You can't be the sign guy, you know. So you like switch it out, and so that people are interested and they're talking. And one of this piece, the guy comes out, owner of the gallery, and he looks in the back of the truck and he sees it. And he goes, "What's that?" And I go, "Well, that one was that's fear. that one is like I don't know what happened, man. It's just." He goes, "Well, get that out." He says, "That's the best piece you've done."
No
so
way.
So what does that tell you about life?
Yeah.
The thing that you're most afraid of becomes the one that exposes whatever that vulnerability is in you that relates to other people and makes it this thing. So it's up on the wall, and this guy comes up and he says to me, "I've been to Paris. I've been to these famous galleries. I've never seen a piece of art that strikes me like this." Wow. And I went, "Well, you should buy it." Because it's just like, you know, he goes, "Well, I don't know. I go, "Oh, what do you do for a living?" And he goes, "Well, I'm a director of this, but I'm also a photographer." I go, "You're a photographer. You're going to ask me, because if someone buys this, to make another one for you."
Yeah,
I don't think I can. I can make another one like it, but it won't be this. Yeah. This has that energy is imbued in here. It's in it.
Yeah.
And he goes, "What do you mean?" And I go, "Like, you go tomorrow. You meet me here. Take a picture of the fire hydrant out front. Exactly 9:00. Come back the next day and take that picture. It's not going to be the same. Mm-hmm. You can never make it the same. Mm-hmm. This one is like that." So he goes, "Yeah, I got to think about it." So this other, the gallery had a representation of a guy who was managing the art and the customers. And he walks up to me and he goes, "I need you to make a stink." And I go, "Why?" He goes, "Because there's a person over here who doesn't want to pay the full price for that painting." And I go, "Well, what do they want to pay?" It was marginally less. I go, "Well, where are they?" "They're right over there." "Well, bring them here." So he goes, "I want you to throw a stink." I go, "I'm not going to do that. Just bring them here." He goes, "Okay." So this lady comes over, and I go, "What's up?" And she goes, "Well, I just wanted to know that piece, I can't afford to pay what the price you're asking is." And I go, "Well, what do you see?" She goes, "Well, what were you thinking when you made this?" And I go, "That's an irony. I go, what was I feeling? What was happening to me? Or what was I thinking? Those are two different things." Mm. And she goes, "No, I want to know." And I go, "Okay." I finally identified when I was 17 years old. I went on an afterlife trip. I took off through the spirits. Denied it for most of my life. Just said it never happened. But the revelation always happens, and the questions that come out of it is like, you must be here for a reason. You must be here to do something. Let's not, if the fear is admitting what it is, what are you supposed to do, right? I said, well, this painting showed me, it reminded me of that trip. It went, she goes, this looks like you went somewhere and tried to bring it back. And I go,
wow.
Whatever your price is, you're taking this painting.
Nice.
Because you get it.
She bought it.
Yeah.
She got it. And it's now, she sent me 10 years later a visual of where it is in the meditation studio. Mm-hmm. Of her. She's a meditation yoga instructor.
Oh, no
it's
way.
In the center of the.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I went,
I want to see a picture of this.
Yeah, girl. I gotta.
I wanna know where you were on. Yeah. When you were,
the irony is I wasn't on anything either. Yeah. Because it was, but I think there's a high to pushing yourself.
Yeah.
Letting yourself be who that is, that thing.
Mm-hmm. So at 16, 17 years old, when you had this trip,
yeah.
What was the catalyst for it?
Well, you know, it was a swim team, and the fastest kid on the swim team, I was catching up, so like I was becoming faster, and he accidentally thought it'd be funny to hold me up with a towel, and I disappeared. So they were trying to wake me up, but I went
wow. away. Like he choked you out?
Yeah, and wow. They're trying to wake me up, you know, and I'm going. So yeah. I came back, and after the trip, I remember going on the journey. Everybody, the lights and everything like that. Yeah, well, you know, all the doctors say, well, that's just a brain. It's real. You know, it's like a visual of, I can describe it this way. You're going up the tunnel. You see your past, your present, and your future, and they're all there.
Yeah.
And they're all like applauding. There's no hands, but you can hear the vibration. It's like these dots of light, and the dots of light have sound, and you're becoming more in tune with those dots of light and the sound. You're getting closer and closer and closer. And so you're going up the tunnel, and you realize you don't have any arms or legs, but the closer you're getting to this energy, the more you go like, wow, this is like the best. I don't ever want to leave here. You know, it's like I'm cool with where I'm going. And they did a process of somehow shot off into a cloud bank, and now you're out sitting. You're sitting on a cloud table, blue sky. Two cloud spirits are sitting across from you, and they go like, "Hey, Gary, just want to let you know you're cool, safe. It's all good. No harm. You're gonna be fine. We just got a couple of things we want to kind of review. We want to let you know everyone thinks it's what you do, you know, and it's not it. We're gonna show you every word you spoke." And the effect it has on future generations. Wow. Every word you speak, we're going to show, and poof, they ran through it like that.
Quick.
And suddenly you lift it up, now you're back in the, you're getting closer and closer to that beautiful light. Now this little molecules of light are starting to gather all together. Mm-hmm. And in the sound, like no sound on earth, no music that you've ever heard can vibrate through you like this. Sound. It's like you're one. Everyone is, and it's just resonating. Like you're vibrating with this huge energy, and you just want to be like, I gotta have this, you know. And you get right up there, and all of a sudden, this voice goes, "Hey, Gary, yeah, it's not your time." And they go like, "No," and you're falling backwards, and all of a sudden, you're going like back into the light. It's all happening really fast, but you can feel like little sweat molecules on your fingers, you know, and then you can feel the density of the weight of your skin and the wetness of your and the bones that you have, and you're starting to creep in, and bam, you're back.
You wake up to a hairy lifeguard.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're back, and you're going like, yeah, I don't want to be here. Yeah. So you deny these things happen, you know, for years. You just kind of forget about it, and then you just realize maybe that there's something to it. So you read some books, study it, and then you try to figure it out. Still deny it. You don't want to. But then you realize, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe you have something. Maybe there's an energy that exists in all of us, and maybe that we need more of that energy to be put forth here in a non-offensive way, not, you know, just so when you meet people, generally, you know, fearful situations happen and things like you're afraid of, and then you realize, hey, I'm comfortable with these.
Yeah.
This fits. I can, you know, let me just go like this, and then something happens and shit melds together and becomes. So you realize I kind of went to a gradient. I said, hey, there's like levels. I said to myself, I invented. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You must be on one of these levels. One's like, you don't know shit. He's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just here. And they all hang around together. All the ones are like, we don't know what we're doing, but we're going to be wild, crazy. So you go through your life and then go through back, come back. And you sit in a little room and they're kind of like, hey, we got a new situation. You get to pick. So you kind of choose when you're coming back, you know, like, but you're imbued with it when you go, come back, but you don't remember when you're born. You know? So you go through, like, maybe now you go to 2, you get a little more knowledge, maybe like, I don't want to do that, but I want to do that, but you're still hanging around with the ones and twos, and then pretty soon, hey, maybe there's something to this, you know, you go die and come back and you sit in a room. I have a dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father and a daughter, I'll take that one. You sign up for it, you come down, and you know, you go like through the process of life, and you realize there's a little bit of a leadership position. Now ones and twos are starting to listen to you and maybe move around and little action going on. But there's 4, 5, and 6s hanging out there. You don't know they exist. They disappear. You come back and then 4. Hey, now we got a little more. You think we're going to make it easier? We got a little more difficult stuff going on. I'll sign up for that one. But you realize you're signing up to make your soul better. Mm. You're practicing things that make you a better human when you come. You just say, well, I'm bound to. So it's not going to be easier because you're going to be confronted, you know, with different variables of, you know.
Yeah.
How do you manage this, and how do you manage this? So it's not fair to judge people, you know that. So you go like, hey, how do I relate? So you're walking down the street one day, there's this energy field, and people see the energy.
Yeah.
They don't recognize you. They recognize the energy. And they kind of go like, let's get around that energy. So you might be criminally people come, fucking wicked people coming, great people coming, but they all are attracted to the energy. How do you manage the energy? That's the part.
Boom. People,
so you kind of go like, okay, so now you got to, what do you want to do? What's the goal? Well, a 5 comes back, a little more knowledge. And you realize in the room that you walk into as a human, there's a silent person sitting over in the corner examining everything, watching everything.
Sure.
Nothing's really being said. Doesn't come over and interfere. But if it's a sage person who just has that advice, that just has that little thing that goes like, you should do that. And they listen. And everything goes bing. And then that person disappears. Never going to maybe see him again. Maybe you don't. But that's their last trip, the last one. They don't want to screw up because they want to go back to that energy. Everyone wants it. And so now your lessons for me is create that energy here as much as you can. Put into your work things that bring that energy out in other people. Rise, make them feel that feeling.
Yeah.
To live that. So stop denying that these things are not real. They're real.
Yeah.
They exist. And it's like, no matter what obstacle, let's have a worry. Let's go worry about something. That's going to do a great deal of good. Just dive in and go like, you know.
Oftentimes, right, worrying is just a concern about something that hasn't even happened. You're manufacturing something in your head that's not even reality.
And it becomes like an obstacle to get it done.
Yeah. Now,
I'm not saying don't worry. I think worry prepares you for the thing that you're afraid to do. I think worry says, take your step.
Would you agree is a better way to think about it is maybe consider all outcomes?
Yes. Yeah, right? Don't be afraid. Yeah,
exactly.
Just don't be afraid. Because
what's the worst?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the worst?
You know, so even this latest episode, being honored to be able to go up on and paint at Chicano Park with my friends, is like, to me, a blessing. Humility. It's like, but I'm sitting on that, and I'm painting. And I've done a lot of different things in my life, but nothing ever feels like, hi, mom, who has passed. Hi, my brother, who has passed. You're connected to an energy, a spirit, that guides you. They're always there. You just got to be aware of it.
Yeah.
And let it.
Well, listen.
Listen. Don't be so thick.
Right?
Yeah. And I'm sure there's people who think I'm crazy all the time when I'm. As Sean had mentioned earlier, you know, he just has sage advice sometimes. And some, I tell people, it sounds like it's coming from me. I'm just a vessel to that voice. You just happen
to. Well, you got a lot of experience.
Yeah, but now after whatever, how many years of saying, okay, I'm cool with this.
Yeah.
whatever this is, I'm cool with it. And then you're gifted because your life became that energy. Now everyone around you has a community, a feeling, a wholeness.
I hear what you're saying.
A greatness.
I get it.
You know, and they help you along the way in the most weird ways.
It's, yeah.
You know, financially or freaking emotionally or whatever.
Mm. Or an idea or something you're searching.
So all of a sudden you're doing something and then you go like, oh, that must be the, yeah, I'll just do that. Let's just go ahead, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I don't know. You'd think that there would be a reward at the end of it for some, you know, like you, but there's not. It's just an ongoing process of, next. Mm-hmm. And I think the things that people fail to understand is when you become good at it, you think it's going to be easier. No. Mm-hmm. That's when the tougher stuff comes. Mm-hmm. You're more
bigger
prepared.
Things, yeah.
You know? Yeah. So you get through it. Yeah.
But yeah, I really love just the whole story.
Yeah.
Painted it really great, but just to the point you just made, you know, I mean, in what people think as success or making it or something, I mean, you had done it several times in your life, and especially with times were different back then where climbing the corporate ladder was like, that was the path, you know?
That was the
entrepreneurship wasn't this big popular thing, and everybody wasn't an entrepreneur. Like right now, it's kind of the days, right? It's like everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. The days you were in, I mean, you achieved the dream, really. I mean, you went from just a sales guy in a store all the way to the top, one of the bigger organizations in the country, running, changing things, working deals with Nike, Reebok, all this stuff, no education, amazing. But then to downsize, take what you learn, apply it to that small company, instantly see results.
Yes.
So, like, you know, but that whole time you did feel that, I'm that imposter there. What am I truly here for? And then diving in and going for it. I mean,
I think that journey, the irony is people sometimes, you know, how long you lived here? And I go, I've lived in the Barrio Logan for 12 years.
Uh-huh.
Once for 2 years, left, and then came back for 9 or 10 years. Mm. And I told people it chose me because I believe that there's a mist around this place.
Mm.
And I think people drive through the mist and they can see the wonder of it, but they're not going to participate in it. Mm. There's like a secret little sauce to being here.
Okay.
And that energy, what can you not get done here? If you have to build something, if you have to make something, if you have to create something, if you know, I can sit in our local little restaurant bar and whenever I'm feeling like lost, the answer will show up in that little space. It'll have an energy that I really needed to hear something or I really needed to get something done. And all it was a look on my face. And the question was, what do you need?
Yeah.
And that's what I think the whole thing should be about.
Yeah.
How do I get this so that all the pieces fit together? There's a reverence to this thing that people try to assign to it, and I think it's more just a flow.
Sure.
It's just a...
And you're really talking about just being one with the energy.
And being okay.
Yeah. Like, now, would you call that, you know, the universe, or some people might call it God or spirit?
Yeah, it
or
is
anything.
A strong...
Kind of
strong.
All apply? Is that...
Yeah, well, the irony is that in the culture that we're in, everyone wants to try and put a name to it.
Right.
And I tell them, I go, I don't know. I just know it exists.
Yeah.
And that I want to be more a part of it.
Yes.
I don't know what that is. I don't like to categorize a specific to it.
But it's a higher power, higher level.
When you can be here with it and do anything you do to feel that.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. You disappear.
That's living, right?
Hell yeah.
You can just go like, even if it's only for 10 minutes, it's just like, God, I don't want that to leave me.
Right.
I want that to, and so you try to find ways to propagate that or promote that or be that thing. Then we're surrounded by a lot of very strong energies. There's people on dark side, light side, they're all over in the universe, but they all respond to your level of comfort with it. So if you're not afraid to do those things, then you're identified as safe. And it's a carry. You just, you can be safe.
Yeah.
If you're not afraid.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I tell people all the time, small children, medium-sized dogs love me. And I just don't know why. Mm. And it took me a long time to not force that, to be like, oh, they love me. But I now I look at just, and I enjoy that, that's a special feeling.
Mm-hmm.
They just got here. Mm-hmm. That little baby just got here.
He knows.
Yeah.
He's in tune. He's in tune with the...
Yeah, you know, and you can see it, you know. They just, you're like, oh, there's that. So I'm cautious because parents are like, don't touch my baby.
Yeah, sure.
But I'll just flirt with the baby a little bit, like, you know, and they're just, my baby doesn't do that. What do you mean? She's looking at you like she loves you. And I go, well, she just got here, man. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing. Yeah. But I think we can nurture and grow that into more. If we had more of a sense of that level of understanding, I think we could all be more in tune with each other and a little bit. We all need all those energies. You got to be strong, dark. You got to be light. You got to be. It's a timing thing. You just. But if you let yourself just do that through life, you no fear. I maybe examples are better. It's like someone will come to me and say, like, I don't know how to say this to this person. This is going to hurt their feelings.
Mm.
And I said, well, don't let me explain it because I won't have any filters. I will go right to that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how would you explain it? And I said, well, I would. I set an example of just like to help them get through whatever. There's a factor that's stopping them. They're afraid of something. I want to make them not be afraid. That's just a thing. So in this particular instance, it was about a painting, you know, taking too long to do things, but moving things in the right direction or whatever. And I said, come and visit me up the top. I want you to see, you know, first let's go down and look at it from 100 feet away. So that's beautiful. And I go, yeah, it's really good, isn't it? Come to the top with me. It looks like globules of nothing. There's no structure to it at all. There's just like, I can't, I would never, if I was going to sell a painting this close, I would never let that happen. But from 100 feet away, that's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
But I said, why did I do this? And it comes back to being kicked out of museums. Mm. The painting I was looking at was by Monet. Impressionist painting. And why I wanted to touch it is because the strokes were combined. The brush had at least three colors and one stroke, boom.
Yeah.
So fast and not caring. And the next one did the same thing. And I went, I just said, I want to feel. That made me as close as you can get to that feeling again is for me, it's art and that piece. But I think pragmatically, it's the course you take, the choice you take, academic training, precision work, all of those things are individual, find your space. Do the one that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
Mine is color. It's just those. It's quick, beautiful energy. Swift, move into the next thing. And I think if all of our lives were paint and we could blend those colors like that so quick and be like in harmony with each other, to be that cooperation, what can't we achieve? What couldn't we achieve? And we're up against all kinds of crazy obstacles today. Business-wise, politically, we're crazy obstacles.
Technology.
You know, all of it, you know.
Distractions everywhere.
Yeah, but it's energy. We're using our energy to do something. I don't know where the future goes. You know, I'm kind of looking at where, you know, AI and these crazy things that I think are going to replace all the things that we do today. And I was talking to an older gentleman who, you know, the duck boat that goes out into the... we were putting graphics on the back of a trolley car because I was working, and he came in, he's standing there, and with disdain he's looking at me putting on these graphics. And so I walked up and I said, what? And I realized he's an old sign painter. That duck boat is hand painted. He's got the stencils. He's and he does all the duck boats. There's 12 of them. And I went, I want to tell you that I have so much respect for what you do, and I don't know where this goes in the future, because this is a lost art. This is something that's not going to happen on a reg anymore, that you can come out and hand paint something that precisely, because what was it going to be? Some AI visual that's blasted onto a, I don't know what it's going to, if we could figure that out, wow, I don't know what would happen.
Yeah.
But I constantly have to be aware that's where our future's going.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't want to lose
the human
tactile
touch.
Feeling
yeah.
of being paint on your hand, on your face.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll ever go away, though.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I think it'll go away in the way that, like, film photography has gone away.
Yeah.
Or that records have gone away. Or, you know, like, there will always be a space for the artisans and the masters of craft.
Yeah.
While the commercial side may get taken over by efficiencies and computer generated, what have you, like, there's always going to be a place for, you know, the hand painted signs of the world. Like,
yeah,
you install graphics.
Yeah. Yet,
you know, we still made the decision to have somebody hand paint.
I think that's a beautiful job.
This wall. Yeah. You know, and so, like, it's, you know, I think that
people think that's stenciled and stuff.
It's precise. Hand. That guy's good. Yeah. I already said that. That's,
shout out to Nicholas Ponting.
You know?
I mean, dude, he took his, get those straight lines. Yeah. Man, he was
So I think there will always be a place for the artisans and craftsmen.
I hope so. I really do. Yeah. You know, but again, you know, not a frustration on my part, but the phone is... You know, I just saw something yesterday where you can send, if you have this one device at home, you can send a photograph from where you are and it'll be, look like it's a picture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my mother-in-law has one of those.
Yeah.
We send pictures of the kids in her house.
And I went like, is this what's going to replace,
like painting and stuff? Sure.
I don't know. But then again, I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning because that's my mystical time.
Yeah.
And I was watching a show of Singer Sargent. He's an old painter in the 1800s, and they were analyzing his brush strokes. And there was a person young who was going to the museum to talk to the curator because he was analyzing the strokes that this person put on the paintings. And it made me go... Maybe you're right. It's never going to go away because those things exist in the universe. These master paintings from early on 1800s that are still people coming up trying to figure out how did that person make that one magical dark stroke that makes that whole. And it looks, when you look at it up close, it's just a globule of paint,
streaks and different colors.
So I guess we're all a part of that universe. Maybe you're right. Maybe it'll never go away. I think young kids today have an appreciation. They talk to me about how you do those things and what you do. But it's something you just have to do. I think there's a great experience of when you're... I told this to people in selling in the galleries... The ones that scared me are the ones that sold. Hmm. The ones, if I tried too much to fix them, make them look, I should be this because it's going to be better, I ruined the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lesson I had to learn, was it's not mine. This doesn't belong to me. It belongs to whoever gets the energy out of it. So I just started to be like, tape across things and paint and then rip the taint off, and several different layers would come up and different, and go like, oh, that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But people bought it. People liked it. Now, I don't know why they like it. I think it's a part of what we talked about. They see in that piece a piece of them they can translate to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. It represents more than the name of the artist. It represents a piece of them that says, oh, that's you, that's you, that is,
yeah.
They understand that piece of energy that is. But it's weird with people because 9 times out of 10, if I did a commission for somebody and they sold it and they come back 2 years later and they tell me, I want you to make me another painting like you did before. And I go, what color was it? And they go, well, it was yellow, orange, and blue. And I go, okay, I look at my book and I can't find it. And I'm flipping through the book and they'll see it. And they go, that one. And I go, it's not yellow, it's not orange, and it's not blue. That's what you see?
Yeah.
That's an irony.
Yeah.
Well, what do you see? Because how we visualize different things, it's the way our perception sees it.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it's, of course, our different venues and light comes through differently, but you see things differently. We don't all see things the same way.
Totally.
That's the irony of the good life.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, you have given us a lot.
Yeah.
Bless the
I asked
stage
one
here.
Question and you answered all the ones I have in my
head. You know, I do have one final question
because
we didn't get into this.
The hair.
Did the hair come in during the corporate world, after, when did the long hair start flowing?
Two versions. First off, my early life, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19,
20, 21, 22. Okay.
Long hair.
Yeah.
Got the full-time job as a salesperson, short hair.
Okay. Got That's a, the Foot Locker
got,
deal.
Got a shortcut. Okay. Stayed short for most of my business career, semi-short, little above the ear, but not too much.
Okay.
Throughout the corporate.
The New York. That was your New York look.
Yeah, and then, came back 46 years old. So 22 to 46, there was a gap.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a
gap. Good 20 something year gap.
And then it was just like I don't know what made it. I do know it is sense of power that my hair. People ask me all the time, can I trim or cut your hair? And I go, not touching my hair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're not touching my hair.
They was go, it when you made that decision in Laguna, when you were touching the window with the sunset?
Yeah, it was.
Was that kind of when you were like, letting it ride?
I'm never going back.
Yeah.
I am never. There was a period of destitution there for a while. Like, what are you doing? You're crazy. Just go get another job. Just stop this, you know. This, but no. Driven to just, I'm going to do this. I never thought to myself I'm going to be like famous or crazy, but I walked into a gallery in Palm Desert. Yeah, I was in Laguna, Palm Desert, La Jolla, and Escondido at the same time. And I was dropping off a piece of art in Palm Desert, and one of my paintings was on the wall next to a Picasso, and I went,
holy crap, wow.
It's,
and
I just went, that's, wow.
Yeah.
That's
kinda, that's a big sign. Right,
that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But I fell out of love with the system of galleries. Mm.
Because it's like another business. Corporate business.
Yeah, right? And I just said, I think if you're going to create what you want to create, there's a venue. You got to find a way to. And so I did. I found Valley View Casino has 150 paintings they commissioned.
Wow.
Sick, dude.
In the. It's 4 or 5 months they wanted, you know, to finish. So my wife and I both worked on that together, but we got through 150 paintings. And you're like, okay, that's, so it's out there.
Yeah.
But it's the way that the exposure to keep it going is, today internet's good and galleries are okay, but I just don't, it feels funny to be in a gallery again. Some part of me wants to go like, and then the other part of me goes like, well, I don't think so. I just
sure
it's an imposter. Mm-hmm. It's like that guy, he shows up and I just want to create. I just want to when Mario asked me to help with the mural, I was like, oh, geez, that's an honor. But
yeah.
I didn't realize how much until it's more of an honor for you because me. Because you're gone. There's an energy in Chicano Park that can't be replaced. It can't be duplicated.
And you're getting to contribute to that.
When you're sitting on the scaffolding at 30 feet in the air, strapped in, and you're painting these things, and you can feel the eyes on you that are, you turn around, there's no one there.
Right.
But it's like you're going, oh, this is part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's alive. Get more of that. I would seek that.
Well, you could get your Instagram reels cracking though.
I know. I got to get better at those.
That could be your.
At those, but I don't know. I'll have Sean help me with that.
Yeah, I can give you some pointers.
Yeah.
So, last thing, if you could send a text to every young man in the world right now, mm-hmm. what would that text message say?
Well.
A Garyism that you've got for the young men of the world.
Well, you know, I got a few favorites.
Uh-huh.
I think people overlook this question a lot. And I ask it, it sounds like I'm being arrogant. I'm asking you for why you love me. But I will ask you, tell me why you love me today. Mm. And people are thrown back by that.
Sure.
But I would say, when you get good at it, the reason you're asking it is because every day maybe you're a little bit different. Maybe you made some progression. Maybe you didn't notice something about yourself. Maybe they're going to say, I don't love you today.
And when you say that, are you saying you're asking yourself that or you're...
I literally think...
He will ask me, Sean, tell me why you love me today.
Yeah. And maybe he'll say, I don't love you today, Gary. And I go like, cool, that's all right. Or maybe he'll find something in his answer that reminds me of something I have overlooked about myself that I won't give myself that allowance for. So if I was sending out a text, communicate with other people and surround yourself with people who don't care what you look like, who don't care what you act like, but love you eternally with all their heart. Mm-hmm. Will help you in any way. Just put yourself in a circle of that appreciation and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Because that kind of feedback on a regular basis, tell me why you love me today, mm-hmm. is what propels you to be your better self.
Yeah.
Makes you be a better person.
Positive reinforcement.
Yeah, you get to hear it too. Sometimes I'm really shocked at what they come up with. I'm like, but then they ask it, tell me why you love me today. Uh-huh. So they'll ask it back. So it's become a common, I don't know, tell me why you love me today. Now your brain has to go out of your ego and say, okay, let's answer that. And that usually becomes a progression. Maybe you just say, I'm proud of the way that you have manifested the best self in you. You know, you just, from where you were, to what you do now, and you're a good example of that. Sitting across the street with absolutely very few perspectives, never giving up, just sitting there. And I know that it was an interruption by me even coming to say hello. Mm-hmm. But you did lift your head and nod at me and at least say in gratitude and say hello. And then to build something out of nothing. And then maybe in a fragile moment, ask a question, hey, how did this go or what could you do? And then just nurture that creative spirit, that self, and that energy to me, to be surrounded with people who are going to reinforce your best self.
Nice. Love that.
Yeah.
I think we got some of that action here.
Yeah.
In this space.
Yeah. And that's
with this team.
You can't replicate these things, you know? That's like,
yeah.
That's the treasure. And, you know, and there are people that, you know, you just don't want to answer the phone.
Sure.
But if you're going to tell the truth, you answer it like this. What?
Yeah. There we go.
You know?
Yeah.
And they go like, well, I just wanted to know. It's like they're used to you answering it that way. Are you serious? Okay, no. And so to be as direct as you can. And then when you hang up the phone, you go like, maybe I was a little rough. You
know, yeah.
I should have been a little. And so when you see them, you go like, hey, and they'll look at you and go like, what? That's you.
Yeah.
And you got to go, oh, yeah, that's part of me. That's who I am.
Well, Gary, we appreciate you and all of your parts.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for being
here.
Blessing
us with this great storytelling.
Thank you for letting me have a little fun today.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Appreciate your time, you guys. Thank you.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. Love it.
Well, if you guys want to see more of Gary's work, you can look him up on Instagram at @AzulFineArt_Gary_Harper.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
There you have
He's
it.
He's going to be pumping out the reels, yeah. So yeah. Give him a follow.
Yeah.
Yes.
And if you want to see him in action, you can cruise down to Chicano Park here in San Diego in the neighborhood of Barrio Logan.
Yeah.
Look up. You'll see him 30 feet up, strapped to scaffolding,
painting
a mural. What an honor.
Or maybe just walk around Barrio, and what'd you call him in the game?
The Logan lurker? Avenue lurker.
Yes, it is.
The legendary lurker of Logan Avenue. All right, guys. Boys. Well, I think that about covers it, and that was
great
way
show.
More than I bargained for.
Thank you.
But, man, what a treat.
Way to go. Yeah, it was.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate you, brother.
See you next time.
Okay,
next time, keep letting it ride.
Soon.